Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. In February 2014, in the central square in Kiev, the Maidan, we witnessed the Ukrainian Revolution. It was a rare occasion in the history of an Orthodox country. Priests and monks came out to support the people as they challenged political authorities. Professor Kirill Huvaron, a political insider, spoke out eloquently on this occasion. His analysis of the relationship between ecclesiastical leaders and political leaders, between church, state, and society, drew on his scholarship from Constantine through the patristic period to the contemporary world. Father Kirill is a patristic scholar and keen observer of how the cultural wars in Eastern and Southern Europe turn into bloody conflicts. He focuses on the theological underpinnings of these wars that emerged from the fall of communism and the spiritual renewal of Orthodoxy. In Russia, Ukraine, and other countries of Eastern Europe, the Orthodox Church became an influential political protagonist. All too often, religion is being politicized and weaponized, used in service to narrow nationalism and anti-Semitism. His work calls for a rethinking of the Orthodox doctrine of the symphonia, the harmony between emperor and hierarch, state and church. His analysis is singular in helping us understand the troubling movements unfolding in many Orthodox countries. His guidance is sorely needed for the church to find its better angels. Professor Huvaron is a research fellow at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles and at the Stockholm School of Theology. He is author of a number of substantial books on public and political theology, including the recently published Political Orthodoxies, The Unorthodoxies of the Church Coerced. My conversation with Professor Huvaron took place in a park. It was a bit windy. Those of you who are interested, I trust, will persist in listening to it. In the future, our conversations will be largely recorded in studios without the kind of interference that you will hear in this one. I welcome you to our conversation on church and state.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
The essence of the Eucharist, what I was saying, is exactly to absorb the elements from the outer world and to transform them into body and blood of Christ. Isn't the same okay? Happens to everything.
That's right.
If you take
the
ideology,
whole life of the, world.
The whole life of the world is to take it, not to reject it, not to be, you know, some kind of idealistic out of this world reality. No, this is the reality of the world that the church absorbs and then transforms it to something different. And this is, as I said, is applicable to everything, including ideologies. And again, I think ideology, any kind of ideology, either conservative or liberal within the church, or fundamentalistic as a kind of a special case of the conservative ideology, they all are reductions of what the church is. If you consider the church as a conservative organization, you reduce the church. If you consider the church as, you know, as an organization open to everything and to ready to embrace everything, you reduce the church. If you take the church as a Eucharistic community, as a liturgical dimension of the church, you reduce the church. It's not everything that the church is. It is an important element. It is an important feature of the church, a transfigurative, really a transforming element of the church, but not the entire church. And that's why when we are stick, when we reduce the church to the liturgical dimension of the church, we neglect the whole bunch of issues that are related to the social public sphere, to the life of the people. And this is an explanation why the Orthodox Church for so long was so absent from the public square.
Mm-hmm.
If you confine yourself to just to Eucharist, then you are not present in the public square. Then
you're not really at the altar of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I think the church is really something universal, all-embracing indeed. The danger, the largest probably danger for the church is when the church is reduced to anything, to ideology, to any theological, you know, teaching or school, or even to Eucharist.
Could you reflect a little bit for us on the ideological landscape that is at play in the churches in Ukraine and Russia today? The kind of parallel case to what we have here in North America. And then I would like to go on to speak a little bit with you about this whole question of civil religion as well, and further what you've just said around the church's place in the public sphere.
I understand the idea of the American exceptionalism, but the American situation is not exceptional. I mean, in terms of ideological impacts and influences, as I mentioned earlier, the same happened in the apostolic times, the same happened in the 4th century, and through the centuries. There is nothing new here in this country, in Canada or in the United States. The same happens to, the same is applicable to our situation in Russia or Ukraine, where we are the same divided along the ideological lines. In Russia, it is very popular now to divide people in the society and within the church, unfortunately, along the lines of liberals and conservatives. And liberalism has been now condemned as a sort of new heresy, and conservatism is proclaimed as a sort of new orthodoxy, even within the church. And I think this is a dangerous situation. This distorts, this changes the whole framework within the, within which the church functioned for centuries. Well, it, it, there is a, another question: to what extent the old heresies and orthodoxy was free of any ideological burden? Well, I don't want to touch on this issue now, but certainly what we have now is a shift in the perception, in the, from the traditional perception of what is heresy and orthodoxy to what is nowadays a heresy and orthodoxy. And I feel that in the Russian situation we have such a dramatic shift in the perception, and it is, it reflects exactly this binary of liberal and conservative. A binary interesting case, because it was, well, lastly re-articulated, I mean, during last 20 or 30 years, to fit the American political landscape, because the liberal and conservative ideologies now, are now perceived, were somehow elaborated recently by the American sociologists in order to describe better how the people in the United States vote for either conservative or Democratic Party, Republican or Democratic Party. And this was a kind of reduction of ideologies which happened in the American social science. And now we see how this reduction to the binary of liberal and conservative work in other contexts, like Russian context, and exactly works in order to fight the American models, political models, democracy, and what, whatever else. And how it, it has penetrated to the body of the church, to the consciousness of the church, where the church starts seeking, you know, fights the witches of liberalism and identifies the church with the conservative agenda. In Ukraine, the situation is different. We don't have the same kind of division between the liberals and conservatives, but the schisms among the churches, the Orthodox churches in Ukraine, it happens along the, it exists along the lines of the ideological divide of a different kind. I believe that the churches in Ukraine are divided largely along their attitude to the Soviet past. To the Soviet past as a kind of social myth which still exists in Ukraine and which still divides the Ukraine. And the whole history of Maidan and protests and social awakening and the Maidan and the counter-revolution in the east of, country, of the country is exactly about the a rejection or acceptance of the Soviet past projected to the future. The churches are divided along the same lines in Ukraine. There are the churches that advocate this Soviet past, which has been transformed into a sort of civil religion, and I'm coming now to this point, to this question of the civil religion, a new civil religion which is kind of is fermenting in Russia, and which is brought to Ukraine in the form of the Russian world, the so-called doctrine of the Russian world, and the churches which oppose this kind of new civil religion projected from Russia to Ukraine. And therefore I believe that the key to solve the schisms among the Orthodox churches in Ukraine is exactly to overcome this this ideological divide, to identify it first, to identify exactly the parameters of the ideologies that divide the Ukrainian society, and then having identified them, this dividing features or parameters, to try to overcome them, and then we will reach exactly the reconciliation of the churches. Now, about speaking about the civil religion, because
this is a term that Robert Bellah
exactly
made famous
in his famous article in 1968.
That's correct.
Yeah,
about America largely.
Yes, exactly. He did not
just give his thesis about America, and then set your remarks about Russia and Ukraine in that context.
Well, Robert Bellah did not invent, of course, the civil religion. He just described it in a very insightful way, I think, that the American political philosophy was a form of religion, a form of civil religion, and it has to do with the Puritan, the Protestant roots of the American society, of course. In other countries, this civil religion functions as just as a political philosophy or national mythology. In the United States, the civil religion has actually, Yaroslav Pelikan has described very well the idea of civil religion in terms of tradition. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book where he somehow decoded the civil religion in the United States in terms of the development of the Christian tradition from the apostolic times. An interesting, I would say, parallel, arguable, but interesting. So it functions like a religious tradition, with its scripture, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution, with its prophets and priests like Lincoln, like Washington, Martin Luther King, and so forth, with its martyrs and with its confessions, with its heresies and orthodoxy, of course.
I had a professor, a historian, who once gave an extraordinary lecture, which turned out to be a lecture actually on the future of the American presidency, in which he argued that America, in fact, is a kind of democracy, where you have executive power and ritual power in the same person, and that the trick in America is that that person always wore a business suit.
Yeah.
So you didn't know that person was a king or a pope or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would agree, and I've come across a number of reflections of the same kind, that America is still a theocracy. A theocracy, a large theocracy, which was extended from small theocracies of New England, say, like Plymouth Bay Plantation or Massachusetts Bay Plantation and so forth, and extended further to the entire country. But it's a different question how America actually formed as a theocracy. But nevertheless, at the basis of the American political philosophy is exactly this religious component, which gives the whole political system the character of a civil religion. And I believe what happens in Russia nowadays with Putin is exactly the same. They try to create a new civil religion. A feature of the civil religion, as it was described by Robert Bellah, is that it tries to legitimize the government. And actually, the intention of the founding fathers of the American state was exactly how they could justify their independence from the British crown. which was a divine, God-given institution. And in order exactly to counterweigh this authority, divine authority of the British Crown, they invented their own, actually, civil religion. So the civil religion legitimizes what is not quite legitimate, I mean, in the traditional terms. If you take the Russian regime government nowadays, with the doubtful, dubious elections and so forth, you can question the legitimacy of many institutions in Russia. But if you have a civil religion, it somehow gives you legitimacy. It functions like a proper civil religion. And of course it comprises, it gives the government a certain sacrality. It functions like a theocracy. In case of Russia, it functions like a tsardom. It's not even a Byzantine kind of imperial power. It's really a tsardom.
What are the constituents of that civil religion as it's been emerging, or as they are endeavoring to increase the weight of this?
Yes, it's a new thing. It's a new invention, but it comprises the elements of from the different epochs of Russia. I would say that even before the Bolshevik Revolution, Russia had its civil religion, which was built on the mythologems like Moscow the Third Rome. It was a part of the civil religion, old civil religion of Russia, like the mythology of православие, самодержавие, народность, orthodoxy of monarchy and peopleness. I think that Dostoevsky, to a great extent, was a kind of prophet of the civil religion, with his Russian God, Russian Christ, with his idea of exception, Russian exceptionalism. I think, well, he was a religious thinker, but he was also a thinker in terms of the civil religion of Russia before the Bolshevik Revolution. Then, when we come to the new Russian civil religion comprises some elements from that period. And particularly, I think, favors people like Ilyin and some Slavophiles, not all of them. Then we come to the Bolshevik period. The Bolshevik regime was certainly a political religion, as it was described in the works of the sociologists of religion. In these terms, the Nazis Germany was a kind of confers a kind of political religion. In the same sense, Stalin built his empire on this political religion. This was an atheist religion, of course, anti-religious religion, but it has its cult, it has its mythology, it has its martyrs, it has its institutions of governments, councils, and
its way of holding everything together.
Exactly. It's mythology, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Stalin is a Pontifex Maximus of this religion. So we have some elements from this religion as well as elements of the new civil religion in Russia. And now we have a new situation, a post-Soviet situation, or I would call it a neo-Soviet situation, which also has featured some elements from the modern political lingua franca, like democracy, like representability, representation, like parliament, whatever. But they, of course, these terms and these institutions, they function differently, not like parliaments and democracy in the rest of the world. It has been a term, a special term was coined in the second term of Putin, the manageable democracy, coined by Surkov, by one of the ideologists of Putin.
It's a lovely term.
It is, yes, which means just something completely different, opposite to democracy. Actually, if you put this predicative manageable, then
that's
it is
right.
Not democracy.
That's right.
We have this new Neo-Soviet model, which also provided some elements for the civil religion. And I believe that the difference of the new Russian civil religion with the American civil religion is that the American civil religion was founded by the politicians, not by the churches. The Russian civil religion is greatly facilitated or even created by with the contribution of the church and adopted by the politicians.
Yeah, I'd like you to describe that for us in some detail. And one of the, you know, I've been asked by a number of people, just based on the very sketchy news coverage we get of Russia, I've been asked about Mr. Putin's relationship to the church and his devotion and what have you. So, in this part of the world, this is not... We have very little to work with around understanding this. So can you give us a... Can you walk into that and describe how that happened?
Well, I'm not a person. I'm not a person to judge the religious life of Mr. Putin.
No, of course not.
I know, maybe his spiritual father, if he has one, actually can do this. But what I believe in terms of this social developments in Russia and how the relations between the state and the church develop in Russia, I can say that the church, unfortunately, has been instrumentalized by the leadership in Russia. It's not that the church is treated as a kind of partner, equal partner, or symphonic partner for the state, or as an independent institution, like in the liberal democracy. It's a different kind of relationship, a different kind of treatment, where the church is an instrument to control the masses, an instrument to promote, to create, and then to promulgate an ideology, a new ideology, which is quasi-religious or quasi-orthodox, but it's not orthodox, it's not religious in fact, it's a civil religion.
A new kind of holy Russia.
Which is a new kind of concept, a new kind of ideology, and ideology, as you know, by the classical Marxian definition, is a thing that distorts the consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And in this terms, the new civil religion as a new Russian ideology distorts the idea of religion, distorts the idea of the Orthodox mind that you've mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It is a significant reduction of what the church is and what the religious life is. And it is an instrumentalization of what the church is. And I think this is a different kind of relationship than we face than we had in Byzantium, than we had in the Middle Ages, and than we have in the liberal democracies nowadays.
Can I take a step back and then ask you to take another run at this? I spent a little bit of time in Romania and a bit of time in Serbia a number of years ago after, as we say in this part of the world, after the wall came down. I was mainly in the monasteries. I was shocked to see how the monasteries were full to overflowing with young people, women and men. And in my conversations with them, and needless to say, I have all sorts of limitations around this, not knowing their languages. But in my conversations with them, I was certainly struck by what seemed to me a pretty common thread. Many of them were young people seeking some kind of identity beyond their own failed ambitions, I suppose, beyond the economic difficulties that existed. But the search for identity, the search for culture, the search for a sense of purposeful life was really palpable.
Yeah.
And then I recall in Romania, in a little monastery sort of in the center of Bucharest, one Sunday afternoon being invited for a conversation with a wonderful monk there who had a gathering around him, a group of people that he had been diligently working with for a number of years. He wanted to know about Orthodoxy in North America, and I wanted to know about Orthodoxy there. So quickly I managed to turn it back to him, and he talked about how when Mr. Ceausescu was killed, that the decade following that, he had a sense that the young generation was so thirsty for the spiritual life, so thirsty for a life of meaning, that the church had a singular moment. And he said, some of us saw that, some of us did everything we could around that, but he said, there were a few bishops that were included in that, but he said, you know, given the trauma of what had occurred, a number of our bishops decided to become real estate agents instead of spiritual fathers. So they spent all their energy on recouping church property, recouping status. Now, as I thought about this, my mind was cast back to the time of Constantine. And, you know, in the kind of liberal church in the West, Constantine's got a pretty bad rap in recent years, almost as bad as the Apostle Paul. In any case, I've often said, well, look at the situation. If you are suffering from pogroms, as the Christian communities were, pogroms on the one hand, periodically, and you never know when the next one's going to be launched on you. And then an emperor comes along that calls an end to that. And no sooner does he call an end to it. I mean, that must be a tremendous relief. I mean, think of the leadership of the community having to make decisions around that sort of thing. I mean, it's a tremendous relief. And then, of course, a few days later, he finds a way to make the church a much closer part of the imperial structure itself. Well, when you put yourself in that context, imagine trying to think clearly about the implications of that, because all you've experienced has been so traumatic and so difficult. It is not surprising, I'm asking you this, it is not surprising that there's very few people in leadership that have either the depth of the spiritual life or the cunning of mind to be able to see the implications of that and to work differently with it. I mean, we see this in Chrysostom and in his struggles there as well. So I've often thought about the situation in Romania and Serbia and in your country as well, in Russia. The leadership is coming out of a very particular kind of period. Is there anything in what I've said that's... Can you texture the description that I've given here?
Well, everything is applicable to the post-Soviet, essentially, milieu. Well, I don't want to touch on Constantine, though it is very interesting. What you've said is extremely important to understand what happened to the church afterwards. Because indeed, well, I will say a few words. I cannot resist the temptation. By the time of Milan Edict, the church developed a kind of identity where the idea of martyrdom, of persecution, became essential for the self-identification of the church. The whole history of the church institutions, developed as a reaction to the persecutions. So persecutions became a kind of identity for the church, a painful identity. So when Constantine came and changed the situation, it was a shock.
Traumatic.
A traumatic shock for the church. And this actually made the church to embrace the empire. To indicate, as I said earlier, to show its openness to the world, and particularly to the empire as a part of that world. And then the changes followed. Well, the difference of the post-Soviet situation with the pre-Constantine, with the Constantine situation, is that the Soviet model of relationship between the church and the state, though it varied from the country to country, Romania was probably the less affected somehow by the persecutions and the religious propaganda. But still, the Soviet model was about the relations between the church leadership, bishops, and the state, the state apparatus, so to say. It was a joke. Well, it's not a joke, but it was a reality that bishops were kind of encaged to a golden cage, to golden cages. They were prosperous men, a wealthy man in the late period of the Soviet regimes, because under Stalin, almost all of them, they were exterminated or sent to the camps. But under Brezhnev, for instance, in the Soviet Union, the church was relatively wealthy, the bishops were fine, but the relationship of the church leadership with the people was damaged, if not destroyed completely. The bishops were reliant mostly on the state apparatchiks. And this came to the post-Soviet era, when the church leadership followed this line of relying on the state authorities and state instead on the communities, on the people. The relations between the communities and the bishops were not repaired properly, and they are still dysfunctioning, I would say. And the gap between the bishops and the communities is continued to be large. Now the policy of the of Patriarch Kirill to consecrate more bishops addresses this issue of the gap, and he tries to bridge the gap between the bishop and the community by appointing more bishops. So the church realizes this difficulty, this problem, but the problem is still there. And the same, and when the bishop is disconnected from the community, say, when the bishop is connected with the state authority, with the governor, say, and when the bishop, without accountability to community, manages the property, what is his role then in the church? But a role of a real estate agent. Well, that is very natural. It comes very natural. He is a kind of manager for the communities. He is a kind of local, you know, autocrat for the communities who manages the property. And this has been inherited from the Soviet times, when the bishops were profoundly disconnected from the life of the communities.
In your lecture, your recorded lecture at Yale that I listened to a month or so ago, I seem to recall you making the point that the leadership of the church is identified with the state and not with the people, not with the society, and that this is really one of the great challenges that faces the church at this moment. And your own work and your own interest in exploring the whole issue of civil religion is in some ways to help make that clear.
That's very true. I believe that the situation in Ukraine, the Maidan story, has indicated that there is a gap between the state and the society in the post-Soviet countries. This gap exists in Russia, it exists in Ukraine, but in Ukraine it exploded just because of the unbridgeable contradictions between the interests of the society and the interests of the ruling leadership of the Ukrainian state. The Maidan happened. And the church found itself in a peculiar situation of choosing between the society and the state. The church has a custom to choose to have only the state as a kind of main partner for centuries, and it is a Byzantine situation still. In Ukraine, in the events of the Maidan, the church suddenly realized that she has society, and you cannot stay with both parties. You should choose, because they are at war with each other. And Fortunately, I should say, though it was not obvious in the beginning, but the churches, all of the churches, including the Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, chose the society as their main partner. And this was a kind of shift in the paradigm, Orthodox, traditional Orthodox paradigm of relations, church-state relationship, when the church aligned with the society. I don't know how long it will continue. Maybe the church will come back to the old traditional conservative paradigm of the church-state relations with the only partnership with the state. But I think it is important now to strengthen, to emphasize and to strengthen in order to encourage the church to go with the society rather than with the state. And this is something that I think the church in Russia has to learn from Ukraine.
Well, when I heard you speak about this, it is the reason I wanted you to come, because I really think the Orthodox people in this part of the world as well, they will find this illuminating and useful in our context too. Mm-hmm. So, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been lovely to speak and think with Professor Huvaran on these significant issues facing the Church as well as various nations that have come out from under the umbrella of the Soviet Union. I would be interested in your thoughts. Contact information is in the show notes.